These were one-night stands that lasted two nights at most, for it was variety that he craved, the endless, surprising difference between one pair of breasts and the next, one woman's cry and another's, one soft, damp cunt or crook of an elbow or curve of a neck. For a young man who had spent 5 years of his adolescence in an all-male boarding school, and before that boarding at a prep, his first year at Oxford, and even more that glorious exam-free second year before he met Sophie, had brought immense anarchic freedom. On he'd romped through his mid-twenties, after they'd split up for 6 years, and through his late-twenties. Years when he'd worked as a management consultant and his city salary, and late nights working and then drinking, meant there was almost a surfeit of girls. And then, at 29, he had bumped into Sophie again in a pub in Notting Hill, and she was 27 then, not a needy 20, more self-assured and experienced, something of a challenge, a bit of a catch. She'd played hard to get for a while. Wary, she'd said, of him behaving as recklessly as he had before, fearful that the crisis that had led him to dump her, for she had seen him at his most vulnerable and he couldn't bear that, would come back to haunt them. But despite her ambivalence, it was inevitable they would get back together. As he'd said in his wedding speech, trotting out a cliché that he hadn't taken the time to articulate more freshly, it felt as if he was coming home. And he really thought he had satisfied his itch, that desire to sniff around. During their engagement, there had been a couple of friends with benefits, an ex-girlfriend who tried to dissuade him from marrying Soph in the months leading up to their wedding, a colleague who had become a bit of a stalker when she failed to recognise that he really did just want sex with no strings attached. That had shaken him a little. Amelia's clinginess, those tremulous eyes, limpid pools of tears that had filled whenever he had sprung out of bed, leaving straight after sex. That final, irate phone call, her voice rising in a hysterical crescendo of pain until he'd silenced her with the off button. That had forced him to draw a line under his behaviour. Marriage, he decided, was when his fidelity would start. And it had worked. For nearly 12 years, he had been completely faithful. The kids had made it easier. He had assumed he would be a traditional, semi-detached dad, rather like Charles, his own father, and yet they had changed him entirely, at least for a good long while. He hadn't felt it when they were babies, had been fairly ambivalent when they had puked and gurgled and slept. But once they had begun to talk and ask questions, then the all-encompassing love affair began. It had started with Emily, but had become more intense with Finn, this burden of responsibility, the need to be someone his child, his son, respected. Not just an admirable, but a good man. Sometimes he found them unnerving. Those big, questioning eyes, that extreme innocence, the total trust. In his professional life, he wasn't always entirely frank. He could get away with answers that didn't fit the question and yet still manage to mollify or beguile. But not with them. With them, he feared they saw right through him. For his children, he had to be better than that. And for a while, for quite a while, he had succeeded in being this good man. He had behaved as he knew he should do. Kept to those pledges made in that 16th century church in front of Sophie's father, Max, who had made no pretense of keeping them in the least. He would be a good man for her and their children, and a better man than her father. And until a month before their 12th wedding anniversary, he had managed it. And then, in May, he had been in the house late at night. The new counter-terrorism bill, a late sitting. He had been racing through the cloisters after a vote towards Portcullis House, his stomach caving in with hunger, hoping to find something healthy to eat. And there she was, returning to collect a bag from his office after a night out with friends. She was tipsy, slightly, delightfully tipsy. Not something he'd seen her like before. And she had tripped on her heel as she'd passed him and fallen against him, one hand reaching out for his forearm as her left foot had landed on the chill slate of the cloisters, a sheer, stockinged foot, landing by his polished churches, mulberry-painted toenails just visible through the toe. "Oops, sorry, James," she had said, and bit her bottom lip as her laugh faded, for it was all Yes Minister in the office, even though he knew they referred to him as James in his absence, and he tried to get them to use their first names. She had kept her hand on his forearm as she steadied herself, and slipped that foot back into the shoe, and he had found himself holding the crook of her other elbow in his hand as she righted herself again. "Are you all right? Can I get you a cab?" He began to walk her towards the bell in New Palace Yard, concerned, solicitous, for she was a young woman who needed to get home, safely, an employee slightly the worse for wear. She had stopped and looked up at him in the moonlight, suddenly sober and just a little knowing. "I'd far rather have another drink." And so it had begun. The seeds of their affair sown that balmy late spring night as the sky turned navy, and he had limited himself to a single beer, and she a gin and tonic, out on the terrace bar. The Thames had slipped past, and he had stared into its charcoal depths, watching the lights of St. Thomas's opposite, the hospital where his daughter was born, dapple the water. And he had known that he was letting go of his principles, that he was jeopardizing everything that made him the man he was, the better man he wanted to be for his children, and he had barely cared. They hadn't consummated their relationship then, didn't even kiss, it was all too public, and he was still telling himself he was resisting the inevitable. That happened a week later, 7 days of the most painful, delicious foreplay of his life. Afterwards, he had apologized for it being so rushed, for him needing to consume her, for it felt like that, so quickly and entirely. She had smiled, a lazy smile. "There'll be other opportunities."
"Like now?"
"Like now." It had carried on, their fling, until 3 weeks ago. Intense, when there was the opportunity, but with physical breaks during the recess. A week in the South Hams near Sophie's mother, a fortnight in Corsica where he had taught the children to sail and made love to Sophie nightly, had seen his fling with Olivia as a madness, something he could and would finish as soon as Parliament resumed. He had tried to distance himself once he got back, told her it was over after the party conference. He had called her into his office, hoping that this way she wouldn't make a scene, so they could be businesslike, professional. It had been fun while it lasted, but they both knew it couldn't go on. Her eyes had watered, and her tone became clipped, a reaction he was familiar with, and so was unperturbed by the response of previous girlfriends, and, on the very rare occasions when he had disappointed her, of his mother, Tuppence.
"So, we're all fine, then?"
he had made himself ask, only wanting to hear her say yes.
"Yes, of course we are."
She gave him a bright smile, chin up, her voice all perky and plucky, though she rather ruined it when it wobbled.
"Of course we are."
And that should have been it. Perhaps would have been if he hadn't been a fool, if he hadn't succumbed just the one last time. He rolls towards Sophie, pulls her tight. He won't dwell on what happened in the lift, barely the most romantic setting, but then there was little that was romantic about their relationship. He doesn't need the mail to remind him of that fact. It must have been that that tipped Olivia over the edge, or rather his reaction to her afterwards. A flash of arrogance, perhaps, yes. But he thought it was a one-off, that a bout of fast and furious sex didn't mean, as she predictably thought it did, that they were getting back together. "Thanks for that, just what I needed." Feeling light-headed, he was uncharacteristically crass. He could see that now.
"Does that mean..."
"What?" The lift had reached their floor, and as the doors opened, he stepped out into the narrow corridor and opened the committee corridor door, his mind already on the day's events, uninterested in what she had to say. Her eyes had swelled into pools of hurt, but he couldn't be doing with it. They were supposed to be giving evidence at a committee. "We're now running late. He just didn't have the time." Perhaps if he'd offered her a kiss, smoothed her hair, let her down gently. Perhaps if he'd been a bit less brutal, then she wouldn't have gone to the papers. But he had just left her, her hair less sleek, her tights, he remembered this now, snagged where he had pulled at them, had left her just staring after him. Sophie stirs and rolls towards him, rouses him from the discomfort of the memory. He holds his breath, wary of causing her to shift away, feeling the familiar warmth of her body lying against his chest. Gingerly, he puts a hand between her shoulder blades, then moves it lower towards the small of her back and pulls her into him. She opens her eyes, a deep, startling blue, and for a moment seems surprised to be in such proximity. Little wonder, she has spent a week being as physically distant as possible.
"Hello, my darling."
He risks a gentle kiss on her forehead. She draws her face away, her brow furrowing in a crease between her eyes, as if deciding whether to view this as an intrusion. He takes his hand away, then places it behind her shoulder, lightly enclosing her within his arms.
"Okay?"
He leans forward, drops a kiss on her lips.
"Don't!"
She shrugs her shoulders, discontented, but doesn't move away.
"So if we can't carry on like this..."
"Can't we?"
She looks up at him, and he can see the hurt in her eyes, and then something more promising. A mixture of defeat and hope that suggests she doesn't want to continue in this state of chilly restraint. He removes his arm, releasing her from the circle of his clasp, and shifts back to look at her properly. There is a foot between them, and he reaches across it to stroke the soft down of her cheek. For a moment she hesitates, and then she turns her lips towards it, and, as if she cannot help but do so, as if it is a force of habit, lightly kisses the palm of his hand. Her lids close, as if she knows she is being weak to concede. He draws her back to him, holds her close, trying to convey through the force of his hug how much she means to him. Her shoulders, tense for the past 9 days, are tight, but her breath comes out in a rush, as if she's trying to relax, as if she wants that desperately.
"There's nothing in the papers today. It seems to be all over," he says, drawing back and kissing her on the top of her head.
"Don't say that. It's tempting fate."
"Chris hasn't had a memorable weekend, and there's nothing today."
He brushes over her superstition.
"I really think we're safe."
"We need to listen to today."
She rolls away from him as the clock radio switches on automatically for the 6:30 headlines. A predicted drop in interest rates, a British nurse with Ebola, another bomb in Syria. They listen in silence.
"Nothing," he says.
Her eyes well with tears, huge globes that topple. She swipes at her eyes and gives a surprisingly noisy sniff.
"I've been so frightened."
"What about?" He is bemused.
"You know. In case the papers dig up any stuff about the libertines."
"Psh, not going to happen."
He has boxed those days away. Doesn't let himself think about them. Wishes she wouldn't.
"My conscience is clear about what happened then. You know that."
She doesn't answer.
"Soph?"
He tips her chin, looks deep into her eyes, gives her his most persuasive, heartfelt smile.
"Truly, it is."
For a while, they just lie there, her in his arms, his chin on the top of her head.
"You've been my rock, you know."
"What else could I be?"
"No, really. You've been my everything. You've had every right to be angry, but you and the kids have got me through this."
He peppers her face with kisses, a light dusting, just as she likes it. She remains unresponsive.
"I owe you so much, Sophie."
She looks at him then, and he can see a hint of the young woman he fell in love with beneath the layers of distrust that have built up over the past week.
"If I'm going to carry on sticking by you, if we're going to try and make us work, then I need to know that it's completely over,"
she says.
"We've been through this before,"
he sighs.
"Christ, I'm hardly going to want to see the woman."
He gives a bark of laughter.
Besides, our paths aren't even going to meet. She's on sick leave, and she'll be moved to another office when she returns. If she returns, there's no need for me to see her again.
And I need to know that you won't do this again. I can't bear the humiliation.
She gives a shudder and recoils from him, shifting up in bed and wrapping her arms around her knees.
I can't be like my mother.
She looks at him. Accusatory.
We said we wouldn't be like them, like my parents. When we married, you promised me.
I know, I know.
He looks down, conscious of the need to still play the penitent.
I don't know what to say to convince you. We've all paid for my behaviour. It's not something I'm ever going to repeat.
You're my world,
he adds, sitting up and putting his arm around her shoulders. She doesn't move away from him, and so he slides the second, exploratory, around her waist.
Don't,
she says, resisting now and shifting to the edge of the bed.
I've got to get the children up.
But you do believe me.
He gives her the look, the one she would normally find irresistible, a wide-eyed glance injected with a streak of disbelief.
I do.
She leans against him, briefly, and gives a small, sad smile that acknowledges her weakness.
Fool that I am, I do.
He kisses her then, a proper kiss, mouth open with a hint of his tongue, a kiss that manages to be respectful while being far from chaste. It's over, he tells her, looking into her eyes and trying to convey a conviction he doesn't feel entirely.
Everything is going to be okay.
Chapter 5. Kate. 31st of October, 2016. I lay my copy of The Times down on the clear surface of my galley kitchen and work through it methodically, then do the same with The Sun, The Mirror and The Daily Mail. Plenty on the foiled Mile End terror plot, more too on the all-consuming story of the week, an Egyptian beachside bombing, but nothing on James Whitehouse, the PM's mate caught bonking, as The Sun described him last week, or Liv's lover in the lift. I double-check the tabloids, pilfered from the clerk's office. Not one single word. It's bizarre how swiftly that story has sunk, buried by proper, earth-shattering news, and yet its complete absence is unsettling. Something doesn't smell right, as my mother would say. The Prime Minister has said that he stands by his colleague, that he has the utmost confidence in him, that this is a private matter now resolved. But other junior ministers, caught having sex with a junior member of staff, would be hung out to dry. So what has inspired this loyalty? It bothers me, this old boy's favouritism, but I don't have time to obsess. 9 o'clock on a Monday night, and just like every other night, I have a wheelie case of documents nudging like a loyal dog at my heels. I scan through the notes for Blackwell, tomorrow's hearing, at Southwark Crown Court. I'm prosecuting a recidivist sex offender who, at 2 a.m. one morning in March, abducted an 11-year-old. His defence? He was being kind-hearted, and the boy, paralytic on the 4 cans of the cider with which he'd plied him, is a lying shit. Sounds absolutely charming. I work efficiently, and despite the grubbiness of the evidence, the unrelenting sadness for the child, begin to feel lighter. Graham Blackwell, a 25-stone, 55-year-old, will not endear himself to the jury. Unless something goes terribly wrong, I'm unlikely not to win. And then I turn to Butler, a case of relationship rape that will prove more difficult to prove. The details swim up from the pages of notes, and I realise that my eyes are blurring. Fat tears that pool and swell. I can feel them teetering on my lower lashes. I swipe them with my knuckles. God, I must be exhausted. I glance at my watch. 10:40, relatively early for me. I stretch, trying to energise my weary body, but I know this is less the bone-aching tiredness that comes from traipsing around the southeastern circuit or the intellectual weariness of teasing out each legal loophole, and more an emotional exhaustion that blankets me like the velvet darkness of a starless night. Here, in my quiet, rather lonely flat, I'm tired of man's inhumanity to man, or rather, his inhumanity to women and children. I'm tired of such casual sexual violence, or, as Graham Blackwell might put it, the refusal to give a shit. Time to buck up. I can't allow myself to wallow. It's my job to catch out these bastards, to use my considerable powers of persuasion to do all I can to put them away. I pack up my files, slosh whiskey into a tumbler, dig around in the freezer box for some fat ice cubes, I remember to make ice even though I forget to buy milk, and set my alarm for 5:30 a.m. The flat's cold, the central heating's on the blink and I haven't had time to get it fixed. And I run a bath, hoping it will warm my bones and unknot my tense shoulders, will envelop me in its watery caress. The steam rises, and I submerge my limbs. It almost scalds, but the relief is immediate. No one's touched me since last month's brief, unsatisfying evening with Richard, and I feel exposed and somehow vulnerable as I take in my nakedness, and note quite how thin my thighs are these days. My hips protrude like tiny islands, my stomach's concave, my breasts tight. I'm dropping a cup size each decade. My face might have improved, high cheekbones, arched brows, my once-hated nose no longer kinked but straight and petite. A 30th birthday present to myself, the most dramatic evidence of my reinvention and success. But my body is more scrawny than lean. A bubble of self-pity wells as I remember the younger Kate, and envisage an older one. A grey-haired husk of a woman as brittle and shrivelled as the beech leaves I scrunched through on my walk from the tube to my mansion flat. Desiccated. Oh, for God's sake, think of something else. My mind rolodexes through the news. Egypt, the cloying fog, the planned arrival of Syrian refugees before Christmas, then flits back to James Whitehouse and the intensity of his friendship with Tom Southern. They go back 30 years. Plenty of time for secrets to be made, shared and kept. I wonder if the tabloid hacks are sniffing around for them again, truffling for a tale of class and corruption, determined to unearth some choice nuggets this time. There's that infamous photograph that emerged just after the Prime Minister was first elected, in 2010, of them both at Oxford. They're posing on the steps of the grandest college, dressed in the uniform of their elite dining club, the Libertines. Midnight blue tails, velvet burgundy waistcoats, cream silk cravats blooming like peonies against each blemish-free face. The photo was hastily suppressed. News organisations can't use it now. But the image persists of those preening, entitled young men. I see their smooth, smiling faces now. The faces of men who will sail through life. Eton, Oxford, Parliament, Government. And then I think of the child in Blackwell, the case of tomorrow's repeat sex offender, and how his life chances have differed, how his life has already been derailed. The paper dips in the water, and I let the soggy mass slip from my hand to the floor as I find myself ambushed by a wave of sorrow. An ache that engulfs me so entirely that I can either succumb or suppress it. I sink deep into the bath, welcoming the oblivion of the hot, greying water as it closes over my face.
Chapter 6. James. The 1st of November, 2016. James walks briskly through Portcullis House, across New Palace Yard and through Westminster Hall, taking care not to glance at the tourists who are peering up at the vast, cavernous space above them, rising up to the 14th century hammer-beamed roof. His brogues click over the stone floor, carrying him away from the babble of accents, Czech, German, Spanish, Mandarin at a guess, and the careful over-enunciation of a young tour guide, a recent politics graduate, perhaps, who is delivering his spiel, the largest roof of its kind, the oldest part of the Palace of Westminster, as he shivers in his old fogyish tweed jacket and tie. Westminster Hall, chill, austere, redolent with history, is the part of the Commons in which the gravitas of his job, MP for Thirlston, junior minister in the Home Office, a member of Her Majesty's Government, always strikes James most clearly. The largest room in all of Westminster, it was saved at the expense of most of the rest of the buildings when fire raged through the palace in October 1834. There was no pretense in Westminster Hall. None of the over-elaborate fleur-de-lis tiles or marble statues or garish murals. None of the colour, that distinctive poison green for the Commons, the vermilion red of the Lords, that illuminates the palace, as if an interior decorator had been let loose with a 1940s colour chart while on acid. Westminster Hall, all severe grey stone and rich brown oak, is as ungarnished and sombre as Oliver Cromwell could ever have wished it to be. It is bitterly cold, though, the sort of cold that demands people wrap up in furs in keeping with the hall's medieval heritage, an uncompromising cold that laughs in the face of modernity and reminds James, should he ever get above himself, of his current insignificance in the history of this place. He sweeps on past a couple of policemen warming themselves by a vertical heater in St. Stephen's porch, and on through the warmer, more intimate St. Stephen's Hall, with its glittering chandeliers, bright stained glass and murals, its imposing statues of great parliamentary orators, resplendent in spurs and cloaks with marble folds. He passes the spot where the only British Prime Minister ever to be assassinated was killed, then has to duck around a bucket. The whole place is falling down. No one spares him a glance here, and on he goes through the central lobby, the heart of the palace, bustling with tourists, where a Labour backbencher, chatting to a member of the public, gives him a knowing, unfriendly nod. He hangs a sharp left, past another couple of policemen at the entrance to the area where the general public are forbidden, the relatively narrow Commons corridor leading to the members' lobby, and beyond that, the chamber itself. He feels safer here. There is no way a lobby journalist could collar him, now that the House is sitting, unless, glancing to the corridors leading up to the lobby where they are allowed to hover, he chooses to catch their eye. There is no need for him to venture here today. Home Office questions aren't this week. There's no debate that requires a large front bench presence. It isn't PMQs. And yet, he feels the need to brave the public spaces of the House, to visit the tea rooms, to lunch at Portcullis, to sit in the chamber, to prove to himself and his colleagues that, as he told Sophie, it really is all over and done. Meeting Tom for a secret gin session this morning has convinced him that Olivia and the subsequent fallout is a closed chapter. Chris had been incandescent when he heard about it later, but he had snuck in and out of Downing Street by 6:15 a.m. After 40 minutes of bonding over the rowing machine, he refrained from giving his oldest friend a hug. "Thanks for not hanging me out to dry," he said at the end of an ergo which stripped everything back to basics. Sweat glistened on his skin, and he wiped his drenched forehead. Tom, thicker waisted since becoming PM, couldn't speak at first. He was panting so heavily. "You'd have done it for me," he managed, eventually. The most powerful man in the country bent over the handles of the running machine, but when he straightened, his look took James back over 20 years. They could have been sprinting round Christchurch Meadows, pushing their bodies in joyous relief at the end of finals or in frantic desperation. James resisted that memory, but once again Tom wouldn't let it drop. "Let's face it, it's the least I could do. Probably my turn to bail you out." And so far today, it has all been fine. There have been a couple of jibes from the more sanctimonious Labour MPs, out-of-shape northerners who probably hadn't had sex since the millennium, and some disdain from the more shrewish Labour women, but many on his own side have nodded in support. There have been kind notes, particularly from a couple of older politicians, former ministers who remember Alan Clark, Cecil Parkinson, Tim Yeo, Steve Norris, David Mellor. Not to mention Stephen Milligan, who auto-asphyxiated, trussed up in stockings. No one is pretending this government is going back to basics. No one cares so sharply about individual sexual morality. There is a frisson of concern about his having dallied with an employee, but Chris Clark's strategy has worked faultlessly. James's sense, and his instincts for this are usually sound, is that his dalliance might be a mark in the Chief Whip's apocryphal black book, or worth a paragraph or two in a future political memoir, but that in terms of his long-term career, a line has been drawn underneath the affair. The relief is immense. He pauses by the oak pigeonholes, perhaps anachronistic in this age in which his phone vibrates constantly with texts and emails, but still used frequently. His is illuminated, revealing a message, a note, surprisingly unpatronising, from Malcolm Thwaites. He pauses, looking towards the entrance of the chamber beyond the principal doorkeeper, another anachronism in his black tails and waistcoat, who gives him a measured but courteous nod. The lobby is quiet, and he stands in the calm of the antechamber, looking up at the bronze of Churchill, hands on hips, head jutting forward like a prize fighter. On the other side of the lobby is Mrs. Thatcher, right hand raised, index finger poised, as if at the dispatch box. His is a new brand of conservatism, and yet he needs to channel their unwavering self-belief to regain his chutzpah. He nods to the Iron Lady, turns, and gives the doorkeeper his most charming smile. All will be well. Walking backwards, he glances up at the arch to the chamber and the reddish patches left by the flames where the chamber was bombed and completely destroyed in the Blitz. The roof to this lobby caved in, yet you wouldn't know it. All was rebuilt, just as his career, knocked out of kilter, but not irreparably damaged, will be. The key, as well as being less aloof with his more tedious backbench colleagues, is to make something of this Home Office brief, a potential poison chalice, though Tom knows he can shine. He'll get back to the office now, and he strides down the Commons corridor, leaving the inner sanctum, the beating heart of this house, behind. He crosses into the peers' lobbies, all thick red carpet and panelled walls, topped with the crests in peacock blue and gold leaf of attorney generals. An elderly peer totters to the printed paper office and nods. Neither speaks. The atmosphere as hushed as a Trappist monastery, though the high Victorian Gothic decor is far from austere. He prefers this sumptuousness and secrecy to the shiny openness of Portcullis, the modern part of Parliament, with its vast fig-tree-lined atrium, though it might have been better if that committee meeting had been in that part of the Commons. For a moment he considers how events could have been different. There, the doors of the lifts are made of glass. He shoves the thought aside and takes a shortcut down a spiral staircase and through a maze of admin offices before emerging into a yard at the far end of the building, sheeted in plastic and barricaded in scaffolding, right by Black Rod's entrance. The autumn sunshine is beating down, and behind him the Thames sparkles and reminds him of the golden bits of Oxford. He has long since compartmentalised the not-so-golden bit. And then Tom had to allude to it this morning. Let's face it, it's the least I could do. Probably my turn to bail you out. Mr. Whitehouse, the voice drags him from his thoughts. A middle-aged man and a woman in her early 30s come towards him as he prepares to cross Millbank and stride down towards the Home Office. May I help? Can I ask that you make an appointment? He glances behind him in the direction of the Commons, with its police protection and security guards. It's not that he is wary of meeting members of the public, but he'd rather not, particularly since this man is making for him with the smirk of a nutter. "We were hoping you could make an appointment with us," the man says, coming closer. The woman, not bad-looking, the assessment is automatic, though her ill-fitting trouser suit and lank haircut do little for her, follows a pace behind. "I'm sorry?" James notes the twang of his voice, but then the man flicks a Met Police ID card from his wallet, and James's smile hardens into a rictus grin.
"Detective Sergeant Willis, this is my colleague, Detective Constable Ryden. We've been trying to contact you, Mr. Whitehouse, but your office seemed unaware of your whereabouts."
He says this with an easy smile, though his eyes don't waver. His voice, stuffed with glottal stops, holds an edge. I switched my mobile off for an hour. Criminal behaviour, I know. James chooses his words deliberately, trying for a smile that is unforthcoming. Occasionally I do, at lunchtime. I just wanted to be able to think. He smiles again and offers his right hand. The detective looks down at it as if it is something he would not normally encounter and refrains from taking it. James, affecting not to notice, moves his hand as if to guide them. Perhaps we could talk elsewhere? In my office at the department? I'm heading there.
I think you might prefer that,
the other man says. His junior, slim and delicate-featured, nods, implacable. He wonders what it would take to make her smile, and at the same time, where the most discreet place would be. Perhaps you could tell me what you'd like to discuss, he says. His breath is coming quickly, and he concentrates on slowing it down.
Olivia Lytton,
D.S. Willis says, looking at him directly. He rolls back his shoulders, surprisingly broad for a slim man, and suddenly becomes more imposing.
We're here to ask you a few questions in connection with an allegation of rape.
Chapter 7. Kate. 9th of December 2016. Friday night, and I'm in a good mood as I make my way up the path to my oldest friend Ali's house, in a suburban street in West London. It's a week since Brian handed me the first set of papers for White House, and I'm still queasy with excitement at the thought of bringing this case to court. Ooh, fizz. Christmas, or have you won a case? Ali gives me a brisk kiss on the cheek as she takes the cold Prosecco and the bunch of flowers I bundle into her arms. I've just been given a good one, I explain as I follow her through the hall of her Edwardian terrace. A forest of coats sways against me, and I'm enveloped by the smell of lasagna, onions, garlic, caramelised meat, as I move into her cluttered kitchen at the back of the house. The house is busy, one child raiding a cupboard. But I'm hungry, another playing the piano badly, fingers floundering over the same bar, then racing onwards louder and apparently oblivious. Only Joel at 7, the youngest, and my godson, is quiet as he works on the box of Lego I brought him in the hope of buying an hour's uninterrupted chat with his mother. 15 minutes after ripping it open, he's almost completed the apparently not-so-elaborate task. Ali places a mug of tea in front of me, sweeps aside a day-old guardian. She's busy, but then she's always busy, teaching 4 days a week, bringing up 3 children aged 7 to 13, being a wife to Ed. She never needs to point out her busyness. It's just there, a fact, and one in which I often sense a strain of resentment, as if her busyness is of a richer texture than mine. Motherhood, marriage, and a career. Not a career as high-flying or well-paid as mine, but still a career, drain her, so that by Friday night she's probably not in the mood to listen to my triumphs, still less my problems. It's lovely to see me, but she could do without it at the end of a long week. Really, she could. I imagine her thinking this, of course. She gives no indication, but I sense it simmering, implicit in her quick glance at my new handbag, oversized and of firm, rich leather, suggested by the utter exhaustion cloaking her face. It seeps out as she finally sits down, breath rushing from her like air from a deflated balloon, and as she scrapes her hair into a ponytail with quick, sharp movements and a grimace. It's even implied by her hair, fine grey streaks and dirty blonde strands in which the roots need doing, and the fact that her forehead seems permanently furrowed between 2 unkempt brows. I like your glasses. Are they new? I ask, wanting to say something positive. Oh, these. She takes them off and peers at them as if seeing them for the first time. One arm's bent and the lenses are smudged with finger marks. She thrusts them back on, flashes a look that manages to be both wry and defiant. They're ancient. Can't remember when I got them. You used to hate wearing glasses. I think back to the girl who wore contacts through her late teens, 20s and early 30s, who I'd thought so glamorous for expertly balancing a lens on her forefinger and mirrorless, brushing it into her eye. Did I? Ali smiles. Well, These are cheaper and a lot less hassle. She shrugs, not needing to state that she no longer has time for grooming, or to recall that she was the one who once drew the looks. Naturally slim, blonde, confident, while I was heavier and shyer. A gallery of old Kates and Allies in our various physical incarnations. Memories heaped layer upon layer on one another, hover like a string of cut-out paper dolls. So, you well? Allie pushes her glasses onto the top of her head as she brushes aside random pieces of Lego. I wonder if she really wants to know. She seems distracted by the lasagna bubbling away in the oven, the second load of school uniforms sloshing around the washing machine, or the first in the dryer that rolls with a heavy regularity, a repetitive thud. Her attention flickers. I said not to eat anything. She stands and slams a low cupboard door shut as her eldest boy, Ollie, 10 and apparently permanently hungry, tries to plunder it. Dinner's in 10 minutes. But I'm hungry. The boy stomps his foot, testosterone palpable as he runs from the room. Sorry, she says, sitting back down and fixing me with a smile. Hopeless trying to have a proper conversation around here. As if on cue, Pippa, her eldest, slopes in and curls around the back of my chair, sinuous as a cat. What's you talking about? Can you just go? All of you! Allie's voice rises in exasperation. Can you just let me talk to my friend for 10 minutes, in peace? But, Mum... Joel looks aghast as he is unceremoniously shooed out. His big sister peels herself from the back of my chair and stalks out, her slim hips swishing in a parody of a model. I watch her, this girl child, half in awe of the woman she'll become, half fearful for what her future brings. Oh, that's better. Allie sips her tea with relief, emits a tiny satisfied sigh. Why aren't we drinking the Prosecco? It's a Friday night. Once upon a time, we would have been 3/4 of the way through a bottle by this point. But Allie has stashed it away in the fridge. I sip my own tea, too strong for my liking, for she never gets it quite right. Reach for the huge plastic carton of milk on the counter and pour a little more in. So, you said something about a case. So she is interested. I feel a wave of relief. And then my apprehension wells up inside me. It's a big one. A rape. Quite high profile. Sounds exciting. I'm torn. I'm itching to divulge just a little. Not to run through the evidence, but to let her know whom we're talking about here. I can't really talk about it. I slam the possibility of disclosure shut and catch her expression. A be like that if you want smile. A slight sigh. A distancing between us when we seemed briefly to be easing back into being our familiar, gossipy selves. It's James Whitehouse. I break my own rules, eager to regain that closeness. And more than that, to check her reaction. Her blue eyes widen. I have her attention. The minister. I nod. And you'll be prosecuting. Yes. I roll my eyes. I still can't quite believe it. Her breath eases out and I wait for further inevitable questions. So, do you think that he's guilty? The CPS believes it has a strong case. Not the same thing. She shakes her head. I wrinkle my nose and offer my usual bland, straight-as-a-die response. He says he's innocent. The CPS submits that there's sufficient evidence to convict, and I'll do my best to convince the jury of the case. Allie pushes back her chair, picks cutlery from a drawer with a silvery rattle, 6 knives, 6 forks, the cruets held in her other hand like a pair of maracas. She turns quickly, pushes the drawer closed with her hip. Perhaps she's irritated by my use of legalese, inevitable when it's the language I use in court. Hard, when discussing a case, to slip into something more colloquial just as I find it hard to shed my lawyerly precision, my tendency to cross-examine when trying to prove a point. I watch for the telltale signs that she's angry, a refusal to meet my eye, a tension around her mouth as if she's forcing herself not to speak. But Allie looks more thoughtful than cross. can't believe it of him. I mean, I know he had that affair, but I genuinely thought he was one of the good guys. He seemed to be doing a good job, reaching out to Muslim communities rather than automatically pillorying them. And he just seemed lovely. Lovely? She shrugs her shoulders, momentarily embarrassed. The one Tory I wouldn't kick out of bed. I'm shaken by her tone, but not really your type, is he? I tease, for he is as unlike Ed, her partner since our early 20s, and now a rather earnest, balding head teacher, as it's possible to be. I just think he's beautiful. She looks at me frankly. And all the baggage she wears so heavily, as wife, as mother, as teacher to small children, slips from her with this uncharacteristic admission. We could be getting ready for a college bop, freshers discussing which boy we had our eye on, both 18 again. I shrug and busy myself by clearing her table, troubled by her response on several levels. This is what we're up against. A man who will win over every female member of the jury by virtue of being beautiful. May win over some male members too, for his looks are never going to alienate. The chiselled jaw, the high cheekbones, those green eyes, his height, his charisma, because that's what it is. This rare quality that marks him out so clearly are those of a leading man. And then there's his charm. For James Whitehouse has this in abundance. The effortless, unostentatious courtesy that's the trademark of an old Etonian, that cannot help but flatter so that you feel, when their attention is on you, that they are genuinely interested, genuinely concerned to help. As Olivia Lytton found, it can be seductive. I have no doubt that if he's put in the box, as he surely will be, he'll use every ounce of this charm, every trick up his sleeve. Bit shallow of me to be swayed by his looks, isn't it? Not shallow. I'm worried it's natural, that the jury will think it. I keep imagining his poor wife and family. He's a father and husband. I think that's what makes it so difficult to believe. Oh, Ali, most rapists are known to their victims. They're not men with knives who pounce down alleyways. I know that. You know I know that. She starts slamming the cutlery down. You'll be telling me you don't believe in marital rape next. I laugh to cover my frustration, my disbelief that she can think the best of him. That's not fair, Kate. Not fair at all. The temperature in the stuffy kitchen suddenly drops 5 degrees. She's red-faced, her eyes dark beads as she looks up at me. It strikes me that she's properly cross. I didn't mean to patronise. I row back, aware that the gulf is widening between us, a chasm that began with a chink when I got my first, and she her low 2-2, and that has widened as she entered teaching and I progressed to the bar. She's long been chippy about feeling intellectually inferior, and yet once upon a time she would argue as passionately as me, would be joining me in lecturing about feminism and sexual politics and putting her point across, sometimes forcefully. Is it marriage, motherhood, or just age that has changed her, made her more conservative, less willing to believe that a beautiful man, and an upper-class one at that, could be capable of such an ugly crime? We all mellow with age. We make compromises, bend our opinions, become less strident. Except that I don't. Not when it comes to rape. I feel prickly. But it's unfair of me to direct my exasperation at her. This case, and the likelihood of James Whitehouse getting off, has affected me in a way it usually wouldn't. For despite the heat of my fury, I'm good at remaining emotionally detached. On the rare occasion I lose a case, it's my failure that bugs me as much as the implications for the complainants. The girls whose dress sense, levels of alcohol consumption, and sexual behaviour are pored over in the witness box, as if we were prurient tabloid readers, and whose stories are still not believed after all that. Usually I bounce back from any loss. A fast run, a stiff gin, plenty more work in which to immerse myself, for the pressure of my job means that I cannot wallow in self-pity. I presented the evidence, and the decision was out of my hands. Now move on. That's what I always tell myself, and usually it's what I manage to believe. But not this time. This case is under my skin, and the odds are stacked against us. Just like Ted Butler and Stacey Gibbons, there was a relationship here, though there was little that was domestic. An affair conducted in the workplace, in lifts and on office desks, over bottles of Verve in hotel rooms and at her flat. And some of the evidence hints at a casual violence simmering beneath James Whitehouse's charming exterior, suggests, with his utter disregard for his one-time lover's feelings, his extreme sense of entitlement. He is a sociopath. I can't discuss any of this with Ali. Can't share Olivia's witness statement, the details of exactly what happened. It's not that I don't trust her. It's not even because it's professionally unacceptable. Perhaps it's that I don't want to make myself vulnerable. Don't want to admit that this high-profile prosecution of a charismatic, credible figure will be almost impossible to pull off. Or perhaps it's because I fear it's evident that I'm losing my objectivity, and that's something that can never be questioned at all. Let's not argue. My dearest friend is holding out a glass of wine, a peace offering that I take gratefully. Come here. She opens her arms, suddenly maternal, and I give her a quick, tight hug, enjoying the warmth that flows from her, the familiarity of her small, soft body against my tall, lean one. I don't know if I can do this, I admit, above the top of her head. Oh, don't be ridiculous. I don't know if I can get him convicted. I pull away, ashamed at the admission. Not your decision, is it? Isn't that what you always say? That it's up to the jury? Yes, it is. The thought is bleak. I think you might have your work cut out. She takes a swig of wine. Wasn't he having an affair with her? And didn't she go to the papers when he called it off to be with his wife and kids? Doesn't sound like she's much of a victim. More a woman getting her own back, she says. That doesn't mean she wasn't raped before that happened. My voice sounds choked, the words hard, angry clots. And behind my back, my hands clench involuntarily into fists. Chapter 8, Holly, the 3rd of October, 1992. It was as if Holly was on a film set, or in an episode of Morse, perhaps. Yes, that was the view seen through her mullioned windows. A golden quadrangle, a hard blue sky, and the dome of a library seen on the college prospectus and on the postcards of Oxford she'd bought when she'd come down for her interview. The Radcliffe camera, or the Radcam, as she supposed she would soon call it. 18th century. Iconic. Less a dreaming spire, and more a honey-coloured pepper pot. An image snapped by tens of thousands of tourists every year, and now it seemed the view from her window. She still couldn't quite believe it, that she was here, in this room, or couple of rooms, for she had a set. A large living room or study, with its oak-panelled walls, huge seven-drawer desk and battered leather sofa, and a small bedroom off it. A single bed wedged against more panels cloistered away. "You've done well in the room, Ballot," the porter had remarked as he'd handed over a heavy mortise key, and she had. She'd come 14th, apparently, which meant a set of rooms on the first floor of the 16th-century old quad, not a room in the Victorian Gothic new quad, or exiled in the 1970s annex across town. The dark-stained stairs creaked as she climbed them, stretching up the steep, uneven steps, and noting how they'd warped and worn in the middle under the tread of centuries of students. And when she'd pushed open the heavy oak door, which squeaked as if in a Grimm's fairy tale, she had almost cried out in delight. "Bit different from home, isn't it?" Her father's voice broke into her thoughts. Pete Berry peered at the casement above a panelled window seat.
That looks like it'll get a bit drafty.
He thrust his hands deep into his pockets and rattled his car keys, rose onto the balls of his feet. Just a bit different. Holly ignored his criticism of the practicalities of her room as she peered at a sundial on the opposite wall of the quad. Blues, white and gold with a regal thread of red. Back home, she had half a bedroom. Her side spartan compared to her younger sister Manda's, with its mass of Rimmel makeup and plastic jewellery. No view from their window, except the dark red brick of the house opposite, the slate of the roof, and the clutter of chimney stacks topped with TV aerials, the smudge of a charcoal-grey sky.
"Well, I'd best be getting off, then."
Her father was uneasy in these surroundings, perhaps uneasy in her presence. No use playing the proud father when he'd disappeared 6 years earlier, leaving his wife and two kids. He was only here because she had had too much luggage to carry. She wished she'd packed more lightly, rather than deal with the embarrassment of their small talk in the Nissan Micra. His overt jolliness, a mix of pride and barely suppressed chippiness, perhaps even nerves, that filled that tinny space. Her suitcase and rucksack sat between them.
"Well, bye, love."
He came towards her gruffly, opening his arms. He expected a hug. She stood stiffly inside them.
"I'm proud of you."
He pulled away.
"No driving down cul-de-sacs for you, eh?"
A driving instructor, he laughed at his customary quip.
"No, I suppose not."
She managed the expected smile.
"You be good."
"Like you?" she felt like asking, for it was his habitual philandering, a compulsion to seduce the women he taught, and his surprising success at this, that had seen him abandon family life. She let it go.
"I'll try," she said. "Good girl."
He rattled the keys in his pockets again. Didn't think to offer her any cash, for she had a full grant, money was tight, and it wouldn't have occurred to him to do so.
"Well," he said again, "best be going, then."
She didn't suggest finding a pub for lunch, or even the local wimpy bar. Down in the quad, her peers were streaming out into the autumn sunshine with their parents. A river of navy blazers and smart camel coats topped with shining, well-cut hair. A peal of laughter rang up. Her father throwing his head back, then placing an arm around his boy's shoulder. Her mother put her hand to the small of her daughter's back, steered the tall, blonde girl towards the porter's lodge, past a trolley piled high with matching luggage. There was a uniformity to these families. Slim, tall, well-dressed, entitled. A sense that these students arriving to start college were at ease, that they knew they belonged here. The thought of being seen with her dad, with his too loud laugh, his black leather jacket and his paunch hanging over his jeans, made her nervous. Every single thing about him would jar.
"Yes," she said,
and swallowed, for she still wanted to cling to all that was familiar while she could feel herself trying to repel it.
"Yes, perhaps you had."
Left alone, she could relax, or try to. She lay on her bed, unmade, for she would do that in a minute, and stared at the ceiling, then sprang up, for she was jittery, too excited to keep still, her stomach a jumble of nerves. She wouldn't venture out into the sunshine of the quad just yet, though, but would get her bearings. Find the toilet, at the top of the staircase, she thought the second year that had shown them up here had said. Perhaps see if she could find her neighbours. On her way up, she passed a cubbyhole, set back in the panelling. A cupboard cut away to reveal a small fridge. She peered inside. No milk, but on the wire racks, three bottles, topped with fat corks held fast with wire and decorated with gold labels. Even she, who had never seen a bottle of the stuff in real life, knew this was champagne. A door above her opened and a face peered out. A boy, a young man really, older than her, with a mass of long auburn curls and a look of lazy amusement on his face. "Plundering my supply?" His voice had a plum in it. "No, honest." She straightened, as if caught red-handed. "Ned Iddesleigh Flight." He held out a hand. Bemused, she climbed.